Hello and welcome. Welcome to session number 154 of the 2009 Salt Lake Symposium. The title is Immersed in All Things Mormon Except the Font. And our speaker is going to be Jeffrey Needle, who's a religious questioner who began studying Mormonism more than two decades ago, but has never joined. He's a book review editor also for the Association of Mormon Letters. And without further ado, here's Jeff Needle.
And I have to turn off their cell phones.
Oh, yeah. Turn off your cell phones and the noise makers, too.
And then they can purchase the CD afterward. Every you have to announce that every session. If they're interested, I'll talk to them. I have three important announcements before we begin. If you all are really bored and have too much money on your hands, you can purchase a CD of this thing afterward, or you can email me at jeff.needle@gmail.com, and I will gladly send out a printed copy. They make wonderful dartboards. In case some of you have missed the importance of today, it is the 40th anniversary of Woodstock. But I will ask you, if you brought any marijuana joints with you, to refrain from smoking them during the presentation. Now, the third thing. For reasons that escape me, Sunstone decided to change the name of my presentation. And because the name of the presentation is such an integral part of the presentation, I'm going to change it back. Okay? So, let's begin. Boom, there we go. Let's see, is this going to do anything for me? Let's see. Let's not roll! Why? I am not a Latter-day Saint. But I am going to take off my glasses. I am not unaware that the title of this paper will be off-putting to some. Are any of you put off by the title? I hope not. They'll wonder why Sunstone is allowing anyone to stand up at their symposium and speak on such a topic. It's likely that the true believers in the audience will be as anxious to hear my reasons for not being Mormon as was the larger Christian world in reading Bertrand Russell's seminal work, Why I Am Not a Christian. That is, not at all interested. Now, it's fair to say that I am not, as was the angel in Revelation 14, calling out to the Mormon people, come out of her, my people, that you have no participation in her sins and that you don't receive of her plagues. But I'm also not willing to dive in with eyes wide shut. I suppose folks can become rock stars in religious circles. Remember Gladys Knight. And I suppose I could become a rock star if I really wanted to. But I also know I'm not ready to roll over and play dead, becoming something I'm really not, which is a follower. I'm ready to rock, but not to roll. I chose this topic very carefully, always wanting to avoid offense. I really don't want to offend anybody or cast doubt in the minds of believers. I'm reasonably certain that most folks who know me at all know that I'm uncommonly fond of the Mormon Church and will understand that my comments come from a heart filled with affection for this mammoth organization. If the restoration of the gospel is true, and I don't know that it is true, then it's the best news the world could ever receive. I've spent the better part of 2.5 decades studying Mormonism's history and doctrine, its variety and its oddness, and I've wondered again and again how such a weighty boat can stay afloat on an ocean of shifting moralities and ever-changing sensibilities. Certainly Mormonism has had to adapt to changing times. After a rather rough period of gunslinging saints, my favorite period, and multiple mortal marriages, the church figured out that they had to go along if they wanted to get along. George Reynolds was thrown in prison. John D. Lee sat on his coffin before being summarily executed by a Mormon firing squad. The church had been tamed. Now the church needed to be integrated into the very American society that it fought so hard to escape. Attaining this goal would not be simple. Americans were still suspicious of this strange cult that made preposterous claims and lived really spooky lives. Sequestered in the Utah Territory, sufficiently close to the Great Salt Lake to virtually guarantee their preservation, they remained a strange and distant people. Visitors to Brigham City were alternately impressed and appalled. There was little danger that anyone who met with the saints would be spewed from the mouth of the Lord They were neither hot or they were either hot or cold. No one left who wasn't impressed one way or the other. Visitors to Salt Lake City today make a sport of visiting Temple Square. They ooh and they ah as they visit the History Museum. They spend countless hours researching the names and pedigrees of the same relatives they'd never invite over for Thanksgiving dinner. And they leave Temple Square and quickly forget that they are in America's Mormon headquarters. Americans hate to love and love to hate the Mormons, if they think about the Mormons at all. Perhaps it's precisely this idea of contrast of competing goods and evils that fascinates me so much. I'm of the opinion that religion and life itself are never lived on such a simple level, are never so plain that he who runs may read it, as the prophet Habakkuk has it. It takes the ability to juggle several viewpoints at the same time in order to make sense of the maelstrom in which we find ourselves every day. Which brings me to my first puzzlement. There are two puzzlements in this talk. I believe that Mormonism has at its core a philosophy and an epistemology which, if taken seriously and to its logical end, make perfect sense of the world around us. It takes us from pre-birth to post-death, from eternity to eternity, and tempts us with the possibility of eternal progression, of not just becoming like God, but of becoming gods. But then it mucks the whole thing up by layering all kinds of silly ideas onto the paradigm. Like, do you drink coffee? Have you paid your 10% dues? Why complicate things? I don't recall Jesus being so concerned about the minutiae of life. Why should we be? Jesus made it very simple. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. There's no commandment greater than these. Love your neighbor as yourself. There's no commandment greater than these. A religion of distraction, a religion of distraction, can have unintended consequences. When you force people to focus on the material, you risk distracting them, from the spiritual. When you concentrate on the details of daily life, you can lose focus on the grandeur of eternity. When Mormonism attempts to weave the two together, there can be some confusion. Imagine wondering if you've lost your ticket to the celestial kingdom because you've just had a hot cup of coffee. I sometimes wonder if God enjoys a good cup of coffee in the morning. He certainly has a lot to wake up for. And there's nothing like a cup of Joe to open the eyes and enliven the senses. But hasn't God read the Mormons' prohibitions against coffee? And is he careful to wear a white shirt and tie on Sunday? I ran across a wonderful comment on God's possible involvement in the many things Mormons want us to do and not to do. In his important work on the history of Catholicism, author James M. O'Toole discusses Pope Paul VI's commission on birth control following Vatican II and including lay people for the first time, and offers this trenchant and perfectly wonderful anecdote. During the deliberations, one incident encapsulated all the changes that had come to the church with the Second Vatican Council. Father Marcelino Zalba, a formidable Spanish Jesuit, was insisting one day that the church's policy simply could not be changed, the policy on birth control. To do so would call into question the validity of the earlier teaching and thereby undermine all church authority. Does that sound familiar? If the condemnation of artificial contraception had been wrong, he asked, what then with the millions we have sent to hell for disobeying it? Buoyed by confidence in the new understanding of the church and her role in it, Patty Crowley blurted out, Father Zalba, do you really believe God has carried out all your orders? No, I suspect God hasn't spent a second. He doesn't spend a second worrying about the Mormon church's orders either, whether it be Joseph's or Brigham's or Gordon's or even Thomas's, or for that matter, the orders of any other human institution. Of course, one can make the case, as do Jehovah's Witnesses, that they are God's channel of truth, that the voice of the institution is the very voice of God. When the church speaks, it is God speaking. Maybe God has another take on all this. We'll have to wait a while to learn about that. All of this has a tendency to convince people like me that maybe the Mormons don't have all the answers that we're looking for. My biggest problem, of course, is not that I don't have all the answers. It's that I don't even know all the questions. As soon as I began to recognize that astonishing fact, I was able to redirect my religious attentions from a careless ambling down this road and that to a search for some religious body that is actually asking the same kinds of questions I'm asking. I haven't found that body yet, by the way. If you know of one, please see me after the talk. Mormonism has a mixed record in this regard. They do ask questions about mortality and immortality, about life's direction and misdirection, about obedience and lifestyle, and about authority and relevance. I'm only partly satisfied with the answers the church offers, and maybe that will have to suffice. After all, the Church of Jeff Needle has not yet been founded. I think that early Mormonism understood this. Early Mormonism. It is my impression that the early leaders were far more anxious to go out into the religious and intellectual world and learn, 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 and then bring back that which they deemed good. On the contrary, it seems that the Danites are at the gates of today's church, guarding Mother Church from any impurity. Someone needs to stand up and say, this is God's church, and I suspect he's not pleased with the way things are going right now. Alas, oh no, what did I do here with my poor presentation? I didn't do this right. Alas, too many packers, not enough trackers. Too many who prefer blind obedience to the... who monkeyed around with my presentation? Too many packers, not enough trappers. Too many who prefer blind obedience to the adventure of an authentic religious pursuit. Maybe I should join just to foment some sort of revolution. Of course, Mormonism is no different from many other faith movements. Troublemakers are not welcome. Where Mormonism does differ is in how it defines troublemaker. Its nearest kissing cousin, the Roman Catholic Church, seems more able to tolerate its dissidents than can the Latter-day Saints. This wasn't always so. We all remember Galileo and his heretical ideas. Is anybody old enough to remember Galileo? No. But their recent apology to the late lamented scientist proves that even if it takes a day or two, the Vatican can bring itself to apologize for its past offenses. Can Mormonism ever offer a believable apology to Emma Smith for the way she was ostracized by the Brighamites? Will they one day have to apologize for Bruce R. McConkie and his allowing the near canonization of his writings? And for Spencer W. Kimball, whose The Miracle of Forgiveness inadvertently caused so much heartache and guilt? It may happen someday, but I don't think I'll live long enough to see it happen. And if it does happen, these apologies, much like the apology to Galileo, will have little impact on anyone who cares. Now here's where things get a little sticky, so I'm going to ask you just to hang in there with me, okay? It may be that the greatest triumph of Mormonism is what I've called the transubstantiation of Mormon history and doctrine. And if I confuse you while I'm talking, please let me know, and I'll go back. During the question period, I can go back to it. Roman Catholics and others in the larger Catholic tradition accept the idea that the elements of communion are transubstantiated into the real presence of Christ, body and blood. The accidents, those things that are accidental to those elements, such as taste, odor, color, etc., don't change. Neither do they matter. A wafer is a wafer is a wafer. But the substance of the wafer changes in a real way into Christ's body. Mormonism likewise transubstantiates itself. Take, for example, the historicity of the Book of Mormon. Lehi, Nephi, Bountiful, and Zarahemla are considered real people and places despite a lack of physical evidence. The Book of Mormon has become a sacrament of sorts, where belief and testimony are married in a kind of shotgun wedding. Efforts to demonstrate the accidents, finding Zarahemla, locating Nephite DNA, whatever the heck that is, continue, but in the end, do they really matter? One who disbelieves the Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation might argue that the blessed wafer can be placed under a microscope and nothing even remotely divine will be seen. The disbeliever thus displays a lack of understanding of Catholic doctrine. What changes is precisely what cannot be seen, heard, felt, or tasted. The accidents don't change, the substance changes. Don't look into the microscope for evidence. Look instead into your heart. And isn't this exactly the way Mormonism works? Isn't it? So much of the restoration depends on historical events. The great apostasy, the first vision, etc. Can any of this be proven? Can you use the scientific method? Can you use any historical methods to prove the first vision or the great apostasy? Of course not. But to the believer, the question isn't, can I prove it? But rather, if it isn't true, where do I turn for comfort and succor? Both Catholic and Mormon are left bereft if they can't depend on the lenses of faith to enable them to see what is their greater reality. All of this mucks up the picture for me. The tensions that I celebrate, but which most of Mormonism simply ignore. Can this religion that wants me to live its precepts fully convince me that any of this living matters in a wider, broader sense? Can I retreat from my own conviction that God simply doesn't care about so much of what Mormonism seems to care about? This may be asking a bit much of me. But on to the second puzzlement. And this one is going to irritate you. How many returned missionaries do we have here? A lot? Oh, quite a few. My goodness. Do you promise you won't shoot me when I give this second puzzlement? More than any other religion, Mormonism seems to have developed a calcified form of evangelism that requires new converts to experience a cookie-cutter kind of conversion. Yes, other churches have their standard ways of incorporating new believers, but only in Mormonism, in my experience, is there a dedicated core of endowed young people. Somebody said I should take that word endowed out since there's mostly men, but I'm going to keep it in there and let your imagination run with you. Endowed young people who are sent out to do what ordinary members ought to be doing, witnessing to their neighbors and to visitors in their churches. The missionary program, I don't know what I'm doing here. The missionary program is arguably one of the most successful efforts that the church has ever embarked upon. Someone must be wondering why other churches haven't followed in their footsteps. Jehovah's Witnesses have their publishers and their pilgrims. But it's never the case that a visitor to a kingdom hall is referred to a publisher or to a pilgrim if they have questions about their religion. It's sometimes a bit of an amusement to me when I visit an LDS chapel. I don't look like a Mormon. I certainly don't dress like a Mormon. Everything about me shouts Gentile. Little do they know I'm Jewish. Conversations generally go something like this. Hello, are you visiting? Why, yes, I am. Ooh, let me get the missionaries. And thus, this overweight, rather slovenly fellow is foisted upon a few young men who likely don't know much more about their religion than I do. How do you let them know that I just want to sit and listen? That you're not much interested in being proselyted? I'm really not an old bull being put up for auction to the highest bidder. I am a living, sentient being who just wants to be left alone. If I do invite them over for the discussions, I no longer get the flip charts. They've gone the way of hula hoops and pet rocks. But the discussions are no less arthritic. And my mastery of this computer is not what I would have liked for this presentation. I apologize for that. Okay. Have you read the Book of Mormon? What do you think of it? Have you prayed about it? Frankly, I'm going to tell you something. I have no idea what they're asking me. And frankly, neither do they. When I challenge them and I ask them, are you asking me if the Book of Mormon is historical? Are you asking me if I think the doctrine in the Book of Mormon is correct? What are you asking me? I've yet to have a missionary clarify the question. When they ask if the church is true, they have no idea what they're asking me. Same with the Book of Mormon. It would be easy for me to project this pietistic puppetry on the rest of the church, but that would be unfair. I've gotten to know plenty of people in this church. They are generally very bright, very warm, and altogether wonderful friends. Many of them have found a way to accommodate the church's desire for uniformity with their own need to exercise their God-given agency. They found a quiet place where the two realms of their lives can overlap with at least a level of comfort. It may be that I'm just too dense to be able to live such a bifurcated life. Of course, inasmuch as I've already admitted that I'm intrigued by contrast, by competing goods, all of this may sound a bit hollow. And this is where I must really focus. Even when just talking to myself about the thin line that separates what fascinates me from what I can adopt as my life's creed. I can spend endless hours plotting how to get 2 dimes for a nickel, but I won't spend a penny trying to get 2 nickels for a dime. I can believe in the unattainable, but I'm not willing to do what others think I need to do to attain it. A dilemma, of course, but not insurmountable. I can always rationalize that others who have gone before me have made compromises of sorts. Does anyone recall, John will, he's a historian, does anyone recall that poor Emma Smith, upon returning to Nauvoo in 1842, after a shopping tour to furnish their newly built hotel, found a fully stocked bar in their home? When she confronted Brother Joseph about this, Emma, the staunchly Methodistic teetotaler, was told by her husband that the arrangement was only temporary, that he was doing this favor for a friend to whom you'd never said no. Porter Rockwell, who had plans to open a barbershop and bar across from the mansion house. Anyone for a clip and a sip? No darned word of wisdom for that Latter-day Saint. Apparently, Brother Joseph hadn't yet learned to keep his distance from the licentious liquor. It would take Emma's stern hand to rid the saints first of tobacco and chaw, and perhaps ultimately of alcohol. We all know that the word of wisdom received in 1833 while Joseph and Emma were still in Kirtland evolved from advice to a commandment, but if Emma had gotten her way, I suspect it would have been issued as a commandment from the start. And that's why women need to have personal revelation. Let's look a little further at this puzzlement, that of the contrast I see between the clean-cut missionaries, not to mention virtually everyone who shows up on Sunday morning at an LDS chapel, with the rough-and-tumble characters of the early church. Has Mormonism morphed from being a ragtag bunch of inspired misfits into an obedient army of faithful followers? It seems at times that the history of Mormonism parallels the story of shredded wheat. You know, those tasty, toasted bits of wonderful nourishment that have graced our breakfast tables for so many years. In 1892, a fellow by the name of Henry Perkey invented the cereal. He started and ended with wheat, no sugar, no additives. Then, in 1961, the makers of shredded wheat invented the spoon-sized version of the cereal, small, simple, delicious. Listening to the missionaries is a bit like taking in spoon-sized bits of Mormonism. Add a bit of milk, but no meat, mind you, and you have the perfect meal. A religion that is simple and delicious. Yum. A recent ad by the Shredded Wheat folks, appearing in Parade magazine as well as on TV, said it all. It was headed an open letter on progress. Its catchphrase, "We put the no in innovation." I guess it's a bit like putting the fun back in fundamentalism. What's the purpose? Why bother even trying? It isn't clear that Christian fundamentalists have any desire to have fun in any sense of the word, and it isn't clear that the missionaries have any interest in incorporating any innovative methods or ideas into their presentations. Where is the snap, crackle, and pop that should accompany the missionary experience? And for that matter, why does this church attract so many Fruit Loops? Yes, the essence of the missionary program is to learn and obey. It seems to some to be a bit shallow and naive. I've wondered to what degree does the outside world see Mormon belief in all things Mormon to be an extension of that naivete, a willingness to obey and follow. Richard Clark, remember him? The man who was involved in this Africa business, George Bush, in his book Your Government Failed You, makes this rather acerbic observation. A disproportionate percentage of the new CIA officers are from Utah, clean-cut types who have learned an unusual foreign language to do their religious missionary work abroad. Those who believe in the angel Moroni seem to have few problems with those who believe in the CIA entry-level polygraph. Belief in the angel Moroni does not come naturally, it seems to me. It must be inculcated into students by parents, teachers, or other outside influences. Clark is a bit simplistic and glib in his observations, but the implications are nonetheless worth considering. How exactly do outsiders like Clark view Mormonism? Do they see the rugged pioneers crossing the plains, burying their children in the rough, untamed soil that marked their journey, or do they see a nearly unending parade of Osmonds and Marriotts? You remember them? Holding to the rod and never looking to the left or to the right. It is precisely this kind of obedience that is taught by the missionaries. They lead the seeker down a short and non-winding road, delivering them to the waters of baptism and often leaving them to towel off by themselves. But this is precisely not the kind of religion I'm looking for. Yes, there are groups of schismatic saints everywhere, and one of them is very likely to take me in, but I haven't set my sights on the sideshows. After all, they can be just as dogmatic about their theologies as the Mormon Church is about theirs. And an added thought, maybe even more so. I sometimes wonder just how self-aware the leaders are, how connected they are to the real lives of their members, living protected lives, shielded from everyday concerns. It seems that they can't help but have a jaded view of the world, and perhaps an over-optimistic view of the church. In General Conference in 1996, President Gordon B. Hinckley uttered five words that shook me to my foundations. All is well in Zion. I was glad my eyes and my teeth and all my limbs and other assorted external organs were soundly attached, else they would have fallen to the ground with a great thud. Surely President Hinckley understood that those words would echo through the halls of Mormonism as saying one thing while meaning another. In fact, even this old caveman knows that all is not well in Zion. For in the very last days, the devil will rage in people's hearts, inciting them to become angry with anything that's good. The devil will pacify others, giving them a false sense of security. Those pacified will say all is well here in Zion because we are so prosperous. But in reality, the devil is cheating them, carefully leading them to hell. This is from Timothy Wilson's excellent paraphrase of the Book of Mormon. As the Mormon Church settled into a place where it no longer feels challenged, confronted by the world, has it acclimated itself so much to time that it has lost its vision of eternity? God's church has always been a pilgrim and a stranger. Its citizenship has always been in heaven with a tentative foot planted on earth. In the end, alongside the acclamations of faith, the exuberance of hope, and the wideness of charity, there seems to be a fear and uncertainty that sits behind it all. I understand this fear, and I appreciate it. We worry about the things our leaders tell us to believe and to do. Author D.W. Buffer, perhaps, said it best, "You thought they were poets, and you worried they might be frauds." In the end, I suppose I may be the biggest fraud of all. I play at religion as others do at poker. We call ourselves men and women of faith, but that faith has never moved a mountain. It's never raised the dead. It has just barely sustained us on our own journeys through life. I do fear that that which I've chosen as my passion for most of my life may turn out to be inspired fiction, and its authors nothing more than pious frauds. Quoting Buffa again, one of his characters in this book, a black man who has suffered the inequities of life and the hopes of the civil rights movement, is remembering his own challenges in confronting reality and the foundations of his life. He says, "You must understand we believed absolutely in history. Everything that happened was either in the service of history or was part of an organized attempt to delay and subvert the movement of history. Chance had no part in any of it because, you see, if it did, then nothing was inevitable and there would be no such thing as necessity. History would be as meaningless as a lunatic's dream." Is all of religion just a lunatic's dream? Gosh, I hope not. There are yet great things in store for those whose religious convictions drive them in an authentic search for the divine. Not just the cookie-cutter approach of the missionaries, not just the hazy exuberance of leadership. Perhaps wandering in the wilderness means letting go of the iron rod. Perhaps we need to sprout our own liahunas and allow the Spirit to guide us in our search for certainty. It's hard to itemize just what bothers me so much about institutional Mormonism. I'm reminded of a story about a Catholic bishop who visits a local monastery. One of the monks is out in the field, working away in a garden. The bishop goes to him and says, "My son, I see that you're very sad today. Is it the quality of the food here that's getting you down?" "No," he replies, "no, that's not it." "Well, it must be the absence of female companionship." "That's not it," he says. "That's not it." "Well, my son, what is it?" The monk turns to the bishop and he says, "Bishop, it's the whole damned thing." So you see, it just wouldn't work for me to join the church. I'm not willing and I'm not ready to roll. I'm not ready to clip my wings. I want to fly. If there's one thing I'm certain about, it is that if there is a God, then he is perfectly satisfied with people like myself who see wisdom in the Mormon church but aren't willing to sign on the bottom line and become full members. I've always lived on the edge. With any luck, I won't fall off. Thank you. I need to sit down. Thanks. Oh, can you get by me? Okay.
Thank you, Jeff. That was... I did not expect that.
What did you expect?
I guess that's not fair. I should have assumed that you were brilliant before I came here.
Bad assumption.
Yeah. All right, we have about 25 minutes or so for questions and comments. So I cannot imagine...
Can I have my glasses, please? There?
Yeah, that this room could sit through that and not have anything to say. So please, let's start.
Come on up to the microphone so that we gets on the tape, please. Who's going to break the ice now?
I remember many years ago, it may have been Richard Paul Volbeny, and I'm not sure who, said every institution needs prophets and priests. Somebody to keep the organization rolling, give the substance to the visions and what have you. If putting yourself in the position of Dr. Seuss, what sorts of things would you think that ought to be done right now and within the LDS framework? Maintain the structure, the drive, the enthusiasm, but maybe be more faithful to its vision.
Wow. Excuse me. Is this on this mic? I don't know.
Yes.
Can you hear it? Okay.
Yes.
First of all, the Dr. Seuss mentioned, I can make it through the green eggs, but the ham will not do very well for this Jewish fellow. In partial answer to what you just said, I have been making the case for about 10 years now that the office of prophet and president ought to be held by two different people. While Thomas Monson serves as King Noah, there needs to be an Abinadi out there who is telling the church what it's doing wrong. When the prophet has a vested interest in everybody liking him and paying their tithing dollars, I don't know that he really feels free to let loose excuse me, and say what's on his mind. Now, if I were the prophet, what I would say to the church, a lot of things have to happen. Number one, loosen up a bit, people. You know, you can't help. I think that there are many forms of child abuse, and one of them is making your kid wear a white shirt and a tie and a suit jacket walking across Temple Square in 98-degree weather. The Lord really doesn't care what your kid is wearing. As for that matter, neither does he care what you're wearing. It just doesn't matter. Secondly, try to make your sacrament talks a little more interesting. You must be aware that been there, done that is the theme of just about every talk. I'm going to tell you a funny story, I guess. I was sitting in Cleon Skousen's living room about, 15 years ago on one of my trips to Utah. Those who didn't know him personally probably didn't like him very much. But personally, he was a very nice chap. And I said to him one day, I said, whatever drove you to write those four volumes, Treasures from the Book of Mormon, if you've seen these books? And he said, well, Jeff, they called me from BYU to have me teach the Book of Mormon class. And they sent me the materials, and I was really upset. And I got on the phone, and I said to them, is this the only message you can get from the Book of Mormon to keep your zipper up? So I knew I had to write my own materials. There is a richness and a wonderfulness about the Mormon scriptures and about Mormon history especially that membership ought to know about. You got to get beyond the manuals. You have to go further than these miserable things that come off the church presses, because you can really convince anybody from these books that Mormonism is dull. That it's Southern Baptists who use water for their communion and not grape juice. That's another thing. Cut the water, will you please? It loses all the significance. Get the grape juice out. It's really okay to do that. And I think the church mainly... Don't I sound arrogant right now? I don't mean to. The church really has to open its arms more widely than it does. I have a friend, Father George Keith, of the Episcopal Church in San Diego, who said once, a table not set for all of God's children is not a table set by God. When you start excluding people, whether for sexual orientation or for many years for color, skin color, no matter what criteria you use to exclude, this is not God's work. This is man's work. The church needs to open its arms, welcome these extraordinary people. I just had lunch with my friend Michael Quinn, D. Michael Quinn, and we were talking. Imagine what a bonus he would be in the church history department if they simply let him tell the truth. It would be the most wonderful of things if John worked in the church history department instead of having to float on the other side of things. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
Yes.
Okay. Next. Anybody else?
Jeff, I've never met you. I've been delighted by your presentation.
Thank you.
You seem to love Mormonism and looking at it. And I'm wondering how many other religions you delve into, or is Mormonism your favorite?
Oh, clearly Mormonism is my favorite. I spend about 90% of my time looking at it.
Looking at Mormonism.
I've taken a real interest in religions that grew up in 19th century United States, and I do an 8-hour seminar in churches called Hearts Warmed and Souls Stirred, The Roots of the 19th Century American Religious Revival, where I cover Christian Science, Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventism, and Mormonism. But I probably spend 10% of my time on the other three, and 90% of my time really trying to understand what you people are all about. It's a puzzle.
It seems to me that sociologically and even emotionally, you really love it, and so you just do you still go to church and listen?
No, not anymore.
You don't do that anymore.
My last experience was accidentally stumbling upon a singles ward. This is something you don't want to do. May I tell this story real quickly? I stumbled in and had a man stand up, I don't know who he was, and explain to all of us wonderful single people how lucky we were to have him there to explain to us the meaning of life. And I thought to myself, you're a kid, shut up, sit down. And then the bishop got up to introduce the newest member of the bishopric. And this is Brother Jones. Will you please stand up? You all know Brother Jones because he's been a member of this ward for many years. But maybe you don't recognize him because he shaved off his facial hair. And you know we need to follow the brethren. And none of the brethren have facial hair. So to serve in the bishopric, he had to shave his beard and his mustache. And I thought to myself, why am I sitting here? Take me someplace sane like Chuck E. Cheese or something. This is just beyond me.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Well, I'm 75, and I'm probably fourth generation. And I had a great time listening to what he had to say, and I agree with practically everything he had to say. Because I grew up in a church, being the age I am, even having only been born in 1934, which is a whole lot more interesting than the church I belong to now. But I must admit that I, as boring as church is most of the time, I have to admit that there are fleeting times when I am grateful for still being deeply moved, not necessarily by the total and deep and abiding testimony, but by just the being excited by the theology that I think Joseph Smith had hope of, and that we have walked away from, and that I hear about from time to time.
Oh boy, yes.
And one of the things I'm grateful for is that I've developed a sense of humor about our foibles, and I want to thank
thank you so much. Well, I hope no one was offended, but I tried to be humorous without being offensive. Thank you. You know, the Joseph Smith, and I used to think that I would have liked to have been a member of the Joseph Smith Mormon Church, and now I realize later in years that I probably wouldn't have found any era of Mormonism where I wanted to be a member, because I'm simply not a follower, and I sure as heck I'm not going to drag a handcart across the country. The idea of more than one wife sounds pretty darn good. As long as one of them is Angelina Jolie.
Yeah, I'm Judy Busk, and you reviewed my book, The Sum of Our Past, Revisiting Pioneer Women, about 4 years ago.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
But anyway, I'm wondering if I'm going to the same church, because I travel a lot, and when I go, I don't very often find a boring sacrament meeting, and I find just a variety of speakers, and I admire the sincerity of people, and particularly, you know, a lot of people that make fun of testimony meetings, but I love to think that there's a place where someone can get up and cry, even a man in a society when we say boys don't cry, or that can express their feelings, and maybe they don't have the English skills that I do as a former teacher or something, but that no one is going to laugh at them or push them aside. And in my home ward, there's a young woman, well, she's not young now, but she's Down syndrome. And a lot of times she'll get up and she'll just sing something, a primary song or something. And we just love her and accept her. And when I go to the different churches, I have children in various places in the United States, and that's why I go a lot of places. I just think of all these people donating their time willingly as lay individuals. And they're not necessarily theological scholars, and yet they're probing the gospel, and they're dedicating themselves to trying to improve some other human being. And when I go to primary sessions, I think I'm so grateful for these little children and people telling them, you're good, you're wonderful, and trying to teach them to be loving and kind and the good things. And so maybe I'm going to a different LDS.
No. I think this is part of the bifurcation of real life that many religious people experience, not just Mormons. Mm-hmm. There is a hedge. The Jews talk about building a hedge around Torah. There is an idea of a hedge around the gospel that the Mormons build. And if you stay within that hedge, if you stay within that area, everything, as I said in the talk, makes perfectly good sense. It takes you from eternity to eternity and feeds you every Sunday with faith-promoting things. You hear testimonies, all these things. But when someone who isn't part of that group steps into that environment, it all becomes very difficult to understand. Because when I go to, if I ever go to a church, I want to hear something I haven't heard before. And that doesn't happen. I don't quite understand all the crying, but people who are part of that, within that hedge, accept that, as you do and as many Mormons do. And you know, I honor that. I really do. But this paper was very personal. It's not why anybody shouldn't become a Latter-day Saint. It's why I don't.
And I'm not criticizing right. you at all, but perhaps the reason you don't hear something new is that you've studied so widely. And so it's hard to find something new.
It probably is. I was at Deseret Book one day in San Diego to meet an author who I reviewed, who I liked very much. And I was talking to the... I grew up a New York Jew, so we're kind of tough. And the author was there signing his book. We have real good BS detectors. They go like this, like little antenna. Like that. And you'll forgive my... You'll all please forgive my description of this woman who was standing next to us. I picture her as a Relief Society matron. Purple hair, big red cheeks, you know. And ready to rule the roost. And she turned to me and she said, "Excuse me, I couldn't help but overhearing." Biddy, 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 biddy. You can always help overhearing. Just don't listen. "What is it, ma'am?" "I can't understand it that you've read so much and you're not a member." And I got a little ticked off at her and I said, "Maybe I'm not a member because I've read so much." Her hair turned orange and she walked off. Yeah, it would be difficult to go to a Mormon ward house. And I understand the concept that many of the people in that ward are new and they need these preliminary things. But the church needs a place, an authentic, authorized place. And that's not Sunstone, where you can go and get the rest of it. Right now the church has no place you can do that. And that bothers me a lot. Anyway, thank you so much. And I do admire and respect people who have a life like yours. I wish I could do that, but I can't do it. I'm just an old, rough New York Jew that can't adjust to that. Ardeen.
Yeah, thank you so
thank
much
you.
For sharing your experience with
thanks.
Us.
Thanks.
I think of the Taoist story of Chuang Tzu, who indeed, after a vivid dream, wondered indeed if he was Chuang Tzu being a butterfly or if he was indeed really a butterfly, dreaming that he was Chuang Tzu. And that, of course, is a dilemma that can only be solved by somebody who can find their way outside the edge.
Yes.
You furnished that wonderful metaphor for us. And to have the privilege of hearing somebody who really knows us, if anything, you know way too much.
I know where the bodies are hidden.
But yet, with goodwill, with good humor, gives us this insight that there are other ways to look at what we do, what we think we believe.
Yes.
Is a blessing that few people have. And you gave us
thank you.
Today that insight. Thank
I
you.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Ardeen. Craig, hello.
Jeffrey, with your insight into a number of religions and as well as our own, and from a viewpoint outside, you're about as good a prophet as we need. So, tell me, what do you see for the future of the LDS Church? Any particular changes? Do you see it morphing as other churches have morphed? What are your insights?
I'll say what I spontaneously said Friday night on a radio interview that I did. I think that if we think the Mormon trek, the physical trek, was arduous, the spiritual trek that Mormonism will have to embark upon very soon is even more arduous. It's going to have to break out of that hedge into the outside world, because the outside world is seeping in, and the Mormon Church is losing members. Not because what they are hearing is so terrible, but because they've never heard it before. And they think they've been lied to. They think that the simplistic, faith-promoting history was a lie. And they're angry that they weren't told the truth. I think Mormons are grown up. I was talking to my friend Richard Bushman, and he says, you know, we have grown up. We're ready to hear the truth about things. Let's just do this. But Mormonism isn't ready to do it. It simply isn't ready to do it. My prophetic counsel, wait while I have a vision. Hold on. Beep, beep, beep. Okay. You know what? Just out and say things. Open the records. Let people see what's going on. If you lose a few people, so what? But you are going to become, you're going to implode if you don't open up, especially in the age of the internet, and when really smart people are looking at you, something's got to happen. Yes, sir.
This is a good question to follow up on what you just said. The Mormon Church is unique in the fact that it has valid, concrete, objective evidence that the Book of Mormon is not true, with the DNA evidence showing the Native Americans do not come from Middle Eastern sources and so forth. How does the church, and if, you know, with more science becoming so powerful, how is the church going to confront that in the future? I know up until now, the general authorities haven't said a word about it. It seems like they're just going to ignore it. Even, you know, the prophet hasn't even tried to defend our scripture in that respect. But with such powerful evidence against the Book of Mormon, and the Book of Mormon is the centerpiece of our church, how is the church going to confront that in the future as you see it from an outside?
I have thought about this, and I think that string theory is the answer. It answers a lot. If it is true that there are other parallel universes, then there is a parallel universe where the Book of Mormon events happened, and there are an infinite number of parallel universes where all the Mormons can become gods. I always wondered how that would work. Now I know. But yeah, the RLDS Church, the Community of Christ, has simply stopped talking about Book of Mormon historicity, and it's all optional. And I think they've lost some of their own members because of this. But I think, as I said in the talk, and this is so hard for me to articulate what I really believe about this. I believe, like Irene the senior man, scientist. He said, I live in two worlds. I live in the world of science, and I live in the world of faith. And when I'm in the world of science, I know all this stuff. But when I'm in the world of faith, then this is what I believe to be true. Because Mormonism has transubstantiated itself, it no longer subjects itself to scientific or historical proof. It just doesn't do it. It makes the Book of Mormon and everything in the Book of Mormon a sacrament. You can look at it under the microscope, it won't change, but that's precisely what transubstantiation is. You can't see or smell or taste the change. You are to believe this because there is a reality in your Mormon life that's much higher than the reality that's in your everyday life. And that reality says that these things are true. As I said in a paper last week, I said, we Jews, we don't make a big point about Moses being true, and we just act as if he were. And we really don't care. We don't stand up in synagogue and say, I believe that Judaism is true. I believe that Moses was a true prophet of God. We don't say that stuff because it doesn't matter whether he existed or not. Our lives are based on ideas, not on proving things historically. And if the critics of Mormonism could understand this, and if those who spend all their time touring Book of Mormon lands and digging up street signs that say Zarahemla 5 miles, you know, you would gain a greater appreciation for the spiritual teachings of the Book of Mormon, which is, to me, the heart of the whole thing. Are we out of time? Just about. Oh, yeah, one more. Time for one more. Quick one.
I just have a couple of quick questions, and they might be related. Did you ever, in all of these years of study of Mormonism, come close to baptism? And if you did, tell us about it. And then the second part to that is what keeps you focused on studying Mormonism? Is there any one thing that fascinates you so much that you keep studying and keep...
Okay, the answer to question one, no. I've never been close to the waters of baptism. I've had those who have offered to baptize me, but not a one of them has agreed to let me out of the water in less than a half hour. Now, what fascinates me about it, is that what you... Why am I so focused on the... Because Mormonism is... I want to say this and then I'm going to close because we're running out of time. People ask me if Mormons are Christians, and my answer is no. Not that that's saying too much about Mormons, but it's not saying enough. I believe that Mormonism is a superset of what Christianity is. If you say that Mormons are Christians, you're not saying enough. You're snipping too much from the Mormon cosmo conception to become just a Christian. You don't want to be a Presbyterian. You don't want to be a Southern Baptist. You want to be a Mormon because you believe all of these things. And within them are the things that Christians believe. What fascinates me is that it's kind of like a nuclear bomb. Do you remember the pictures of the bomb going off and the radiation scattering all over the place? Mormonism is everywhere. Kind of like Edward Dirksen's hair. No matter where you look, it's scattered. I never run out of places to look and to explore. And thanks to people like Signature Books and John Whitmer Books and others, I've never run out of things that absolutely amaze me about Mormonism and Mormons. So I will go to my death not having discovered half of what I want to know. Thanks a lot, everybody. I appreciate it.